and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the transformation of the party formed by Abraham Lincoln into an anti-democratic cult on display at the CPAC conference underway in Florida, where conservatives are now turning a failed coup attempt against American democracy into the launch of a 2024 presidential campaign for the leader of the insurrection against the United States government. Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University and the author of Twilight of American Sanity, a psychiatrist who analyzes the age of Trump, joins us to discuss how Trump's GOP is turning the big lie of Trump's Stop the Steal claims into voter suppression against the real winners of the election as the Republican Party establishes a committee on election integrity. With 253 Republican bills to restrict voting pending in state legislatures, Dr. Francis argues that Congress should form an independent bipartisan commission to combat this Orwellian deception and power grab with facts and truth. Then, with the House passage of the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, with the raise in the minimum wage to $15 destined to be stripped out by the Senate, we'll speak with Stephen Greenhouse, a reporter for the New York Times who covered labor and the workplace for 19 years and is the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. He joins us to discuss his articles at The Guardian, We Deserve More, an Amazon warehouse high-stakes union drive, and a $15 minimum wage isn't just about justice, it's good economics. Then finally, we'll look into the possibility that the claim by Mary Trump that her uncle will end up in jail as a result of the information handed over by the Supreme Court to the New York prosecutors might come to pass. An expert on taxes and tax avoidance, James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who is the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting website, dcreport.org, joins us to discuss what trouble Trump could be in with revelations involving who guaranteed the generous Deutsche Bank loans that kept Trump afloat after multiple bankruptcies. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Well, Ian, always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And unfortunately, the age of Trump is not over. And it's extraordinary to watch what's happened to one of the great American political parties, the Republican Party, founded by none other than Abraham Lincoln, now on display down in Florida at the CPAC conference, where conservatives are now turning a failed coup against American democracy into a 2024 presidential campaign for the leader of the insurrection.
Well, I think that we have to be prepared for this being an ongoing struggle that will last for decades, that the Republican Party is destined by the demographics to be a minority party for the indefinite future, perhaps forever. And so the only way they can govern is by misinforming the public and rigging the elections and voter suppression, various ways to make a minority government a permanent fixture in American life. And democracy dies in that situation, that we're headed for autocracy unless we, all of us, fight together to protect a very fragile system that's been preserved for 250 years, but is now subject to the strongest attack ever in U.S. history.
But why choose fascism as your path to power? Why not, you know, come up with a better argument, with a better program? I mean, if Trump wouldn't have been such a sick man and such an idiot and so stupid, and he handled the COVID pandemic like other countries have from the beginning, where if you don't nip it in the bud, it's almost impossible to deal with. And the reason that my voice is a little off today, Dr. Francis, is I had my second COVID shot on Thursday, and I've been feeling kind of pretty bad ever since. But the long and the short of it is that had Trump handled COVID properly, he would have got reelected in a landslide.
And that's what's terrifying, because what he was doing was turning America even more than it has been into a land of opportunity only for the very few. That his tax break gave trillions of dollars to the billionaire class and deprived the rest of us from needed services. And so if someone as clownish and ignorant as Trump was able to come this far in promoting a coup, imagine what someone skillful could do in the future. And that's why the tools of democracy have always been fragile. Athens lasted only 100 years in its democracy. There have been very few democracies in the history of the world. And this system can work only with an educated populace. And what's happened lately is that we've had a campaign of successful propaganda from talk radio, from Fox News, and now more recently from the internet, to promote the most absurd ideas about what reality is. And without truth, it's impossible to have an educated and responsible citizenry. And without an educated and responsible citizenry, the demagogues come forward. And money will talk. And so I think this is a crucial moment. And the performance in Florida, which made me so enraged this morning, they wrote a letter about it to The Guardian. The performance in Florida of the conservatives demonstrating their everlasting fealty to Trump, regardless of what he's done in terms of killing more than 500,000 Americans, regardless of his attack at the Capitol, on direct attack on American democracy, despite his economic policies, which favored the very few, that there's at least 50 million Republican voters who will follow him to the brink of hell. And I think that it's important that we develop and strengthen the institutions of democracy to protect our elections from minority rule, because minority rule, after a very brief period, will lend itself to dictatorship.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller, Saving Normal, and the reference work, Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. So let me just read your letter to The Guardian. It's brief. And it's titled, Why Isn't Congress Creating a Committee on Election Integrity? As you report today, the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, is busily spreading the big lie that widespread voter fraud deprived Trump of an election victory. And the Republican Party is establishing a Committee on Election Integrity to enshrine election conspiracy theories and devise new and better techniques of voter suppression. Congress must counter these insidious attacks on democracy by creating an independent bipartisan commission to separate truth from deception regarding 1, stop the steal claims, 2, whether significant voter fraud actually occurs with no excuse mail-in ballots, drop boxes, and automatic registration, 3, how much the 253 pending Republican bills to restrict voting access will dangerously suppress legitimate voting, and 4, what are the best practice election guidelines. Data collated by the commission could also be used in an amicus brief for court challenges. We can't let the Republican Party get away with this Orwellian newspeak and legislative power grab. If the people's faith in elections and access to the ballot box are undermined, can dictatorship be far behind? So we came close to dictatorship on January the 6th. That's what that assault on the Capitol was all about. That was an assault to nullify, talk about cancel culture. Trump was out to cancel 81 million Americans' votes for Biden. That's what it was all about. So we had a very close brush with dictatorship. And now the GOP, in the form of CPAC, and that is the new GOP, unfortunately, it's not as if they are apologizing, and they're going all in. They're doubling down.
Well, and the Republican Party itself is sponsoring a, quote, committee on election integrity, which is a really Orwellian newspeak, because it's really a committee to disrupt election integrity. There's a psychological mechanism, an unconscious psychological mechanism, primitive, called projection, where you attribute to your enemy your own evil thoughts and deeds. The Republicans have made this conscious and weaponized it in a political way. And so ever since Watergate and Nixon, they've been doing their very best to subvert elections. Talk radio, the Fox News, the whole Murdoch operation has been geared towards deceiving voters and promoting an agenda that's antithetical to what's good for most people. And now with Trump, we had collaboration with the Russians to disrupt elections, to destroy election integrity, and the weaponization of the internet in this propaganda campaign that's been so successful in convincing 50 million Americans that Trump was robbed. So I think that the only way to deal with projection is reality. And if the Republicans are going to develop a fake election integrity committee that's mainly geared towards voter suppression, it's important that, the nation, that the Congress representing the nation, appoint a bipartisan, non-politicized, non-partisan, non-propagandized look at, was this election stolen? It shouldn't go down in history that CPAC gets to revise and write history. Was this election stolen? Is it true what's being said that by the Republicans, that having mail-in ballots and drop boxes and open registration, that this leads to massive fraud? The courts didn't find this to be the case. Even the Republican state election officials didn't find this to be the case. But it has to go down in history, history written by nonpartisan, truth-telling people, not by the Republican Party, that this is the case. And we have to look at the future to make sure that there's access for voting to legitimate interests, that we're not disenfranchising large groups of the population. And what the Republican Party has done, they have 250 bills all across the country aimed at making it harder and harder for people to vote. So they know they can't win a fair vote. They're rigging it. And they're using projection, the brilliant strategy, accuse the Democrats of rigging the election when that's exactly what they're doing. And if they get away with this, it's a very slippery slope. We will never recover voting rights that are lost. If we lose the capacity to be a democracy, we will not recover that capacity. So I think the reason I wrote the letter, the reason I feel so strongly about this is a tipping point in American history. There hasn't been quite this much a threat to the American experiment since the Civil War. And unless all of us pay attention, I was never a political person, but we're driven to be political because at this point it's the salvation of the Republic.
But can you shame the shameless?
And can you speak truth?
Well,
to
I'm just trying.
People who are watching Fox News and listening to the Rush Limbaugh types, is there a way that truth can defeat lies? Can sometimes right make might? I think it's a very and can you, how do you convince the millions of people who believe the really absurd thing that there's a pedophile Democratic ring and that Trump is going to ride in on a white horse and save the Republic? How do you defeat weird conspiracy theories? I think that the only hope in this situation is, well, two hopes. One is, I think the Biden administration is remarkably effective, that they've picked just the right people, they have just the right policies, and it's conceivable that if practical, real-world benefits accrue to the people who now believe the stuff they've been fed by propaganda, that at least some of them will be able to understand that what they were told before, that the world would come apart if Biden were elected. At least some people, when their paychecks are heavier, when they get health insurance, when the COVID is defeated because we have an efficient government that's trying to defeat it rather than to deny it exists, I think that some people will be convinced by the reality of every day. But I think it's an important national obligation to get the truth out. And that's why I think a commission on this and a commission on extremism in America, that these commissions don't have an immediate effect, but I think they do set a tone. And the Republicans shouldn't be allowed the bully pulpit of deciding what election integrity means, that we have to have a more reasoned way of approaching these issues. And will every person who would follow Trump to hell, will every person be convinced by this? Of course not. But I think it's incumbent on us to do everything possible to bring out the truth.
Just in closing, Dr. Francis, would it be helpful if Trump were to be convicted and sent to jail, which is where I think he belongs?
Well, I think that it certainly will peel away. I think what the election did, we had 75 million people voting for Trump. At this point, polls suggest that maybe 50 million people are do or die Trump cultists. I think that with each and everything that occurs, he loses support, and that's wonderful because the Republican Party really needs to, if it's to exist at all in a reasonable fashion, needs to rethink itself. Will there be 20 million people who will believe that it's a political hatchet job and he's a martyr and will become even more infatuated with him and with the backstabbing, stop the steal kind of rhetoric? I think that there will forever be a population of Americans who will believe very bizarre and dangerous things and remain a threat to the Republic. But I think if it's 10 or 20 million instead of 75 million, the Republic can withstand their onslaught. And I'm hopeful that with each passing day, as truth becomes more publicized, that Trump's support goes down. And nothing budged his support during his 4 years. So he was getting an approval rating of 42, 43% throughout his 4 years, despite all the depredations and the incompetence and the deaths from COVID. His approval rating now is down into the low 30s. And that gives us some hope that it can continue to drop as the shoe drops and as his past civic crimes and political misdemeanors, as these become more public and as he has less of a forum, let's hope that the Republic will hold. This is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party. And the Democratic Party certainly is not perfect. It's many flaws, but it's the great only hope for democracy at this moment in America.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and the former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the need for the minimum wage raise to $15 an hour, which will be stripped out by the Senate from the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Greenhouse, who was a reporter for the New York Times from 1983 to 2014, where he covered labor and the workplace for 19 years. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, the past, present, and future of American labor. And his latest articles at The Guardian are We Deserve More, an Amazon Warehouse's High-Stakes Union Drive, and A $15 Minimum Wage Isn't Just About Justice, It's Good Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Greenhouse.
Great to be back here, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And of course, a lot of progressives and I think, you know, average Americans, because the minimum wage is widely popular, I must be a little confused that an unelected Senate parliamentarian was able to deny millions and millions of Americans a living wage. And I'm not even sure that $15 an hour is a living wage, but $7.25, which the minimum wage has been since 2009, most certainly isn't. So it's a very strange situation, is it not?
So one of the really strange things, Ian, is that the American public supports a $15 minimum wage overwhelmingly, 67% to 33%, more than 2-1. Yet there is a political party, one major political party, that is implacably opposed to a major increase in the minimum wage. So we have, you know, Americans, you know, millions of Americans are stuck at $7.25 an hour, $8 an hour, $9 an hour. Really hard to make ends meet on that. They're eager for Congress to do something about it. Biden says he wants to do something about it. Yet there's one party that totally blocks it. And, you know, they're, you know, the Senate was hoping, you know, Biden was hoping, many Democrats in the Senate were hoping, well, we could pass it by a simple majority vote because, you know, the Democrats support a $15 minimum wage. But and Biden was so eager to have a $15 minimum wage, he included it as part of his huge $1.9 trillion COVID emergency relief package. But then the Senate parliamentarian said, wait a second, you cannot include a $15 minimum wage in that package because it doesn't involve the budget. So that means it will have to be stricken from the package, and then it is subject to a filibuster. And it's very hard to get the 60 votes when no Republicans will back a $15 minimum wage. So we have this crazy situation where the public overwhelmingly wants something, yet Congress is listening to, you know, what business, what the rich and what business owners want instead of what the American people want. And that's another example of our system being broken.
Well, at least one Senate Democrat, Joe Manchin, wasn't he opposed to the raising the minimum wage, even though he comes from one of the poorest states in America, West Virginia?
Yes, Joe Manchin has come out opposed to a $15 minimum wage, although I do think that if it was included in the overall emergency relief package, and Manchin very, very, very much wants that package to be passed, Biden could have probably persuaded Manchin to support the overall package, even with it including a $15 minimum wage. Or maybe there could have been a minor compromise to extend how soon the minimum wage would rise to $15 in West Virginia, because Manchin says, well, we can't have it jump to $15 very quickly in West Virginia. That will put some restaurant owners I know out of business. But I think that if the Senate parliamentarian allowed the $15 minimum to be included in the $1.9 trillion package, Biden would have found a way to get the votes needed. And this harkens back to what I wrote in my book, that something about the American system greatly favors corporations over workers, that workers don't have nearly enough voice and power in our politics and in our policy making.
Well, you point out in your article, Stephen Greenhouse at The Guardian, that, for example, in Denmark, a McDonald's hamburger flipper or somebody that works for McDonald's gets an average of $22 an hour, along with 6 weeks paid vacation. And that among the world's wealthiest nations, of the 37 nations in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the U.S. has the third highest percentage of low-wage workers, only better off than Latvia and Romania. And in another study, Brookings Institution found that 53 million Americans hold low-wage jobs with a median pay of $10.22 an hour and a median annual earnings of $17,950. So
Ian, we once, I think we discussed this another time. You know, I think one of the big problems we have in America is what I call its anti-worker exceptionalism, that because corporations and rich donors have such inordinate power, Ian, and because workers and unions have a much weaker voice in politics and policymaking, now, things are really extremely skewed against workers in public policy here. And that's why we, the United States, are the only industrial nation that doesn't have a law guaranteeing all workers paid sick days. We're the only industrial nation that doesn't have a law guaranteeing all workers paid parental leave and paid maternity leave. We're the only industrial nation that doesn't have a law guaranteeing all workers paid vacation. In the 27 nations of the European Union, every worker is guaranteed at least 4 weeks vacation. In France and Denmark, they're guaranteed 6 weeks vacation. And we have, of the G7 industrial nations, we have the lowest wage in terms of lowest minimum wage in terms of purchasing power. We have the greatest income inequality, the highest poverty rate. And things are really broken for American workers. And you know, one of the reasons I wrote my book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, is that far too few Americans understand how broken and tilted the system is against workers. And you know, Donald Trump promised that he was going to be the great hero who rushes to help workers. But as soon as he was elected, he turned his back on workers and you know, took one decision after another decision in favor of corporations, the huge tax cuts, and really screwed workers many, many ways. And it's promising that Biden has said he's going to be the most pro-union president we've ever seen. And he really wants to give workers more power and more voice. And I think it's very promising that right out of the blocks, starting blocks, he's pushing for a $15 minimum wage. So, you know, as I say in my book, things are really tilted in a bad way against workers in America. You know, that's one reason the minimum wage hasn't increased in 11 years, the longest time in history it hasn't increased, even though the American public overwhelmingly supports a higher minimum wage. And again, so many folks in Washington, especially Republicans, listen far, far, far more to their corporate donors than to their constituents who make $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 a year. It's part of our system being broken, and many politicians just turning a deaf ear to the average worker.
So let's talk a little bit about your other article on the Amazon workplace down there in Bessemer, Alabama, where you profile a worker who was a picker who had this incredibly tough job, which they all do. He's monitored by all kinds of cameras. He has to just physically move stuff around at a great pace. And he started to try and organize. And what did he come up against?
So he, you know, Amazon, you know, is a vehemently anti-union company. It really pulls out the stops. You know, it's running a very fierce anti-union campaign. It sends each of the workers 3, 4, 5 anti-union texts each day. It orders, you know, all the workers into meetings where they have anti-union speakers telling the workers, unions stink. You know, if there's a union, you're never going to be able to speak to managers again. If there's a union, you might see your wages and benefits go down, which is, you know, not true. You know, and Amazon has also said, if you have a union, you're going to have to pay union dues. And, you know, why should you pay union dues when we, Amazon, treat you so well? That's a falsehood, because Alabama is a right to work state, meaning that at unionized workplaces, workers cannot be required to pay union dues. And one of the crazy things, Ian, that Amazon is so anti-worker that in the bathroom stalls themselves, each bathroom stall has a poster, an anti-union poster that, you know, says nasty things about unions. And I interviewed some of the workers and say, you know, you go to the toilet, you want to sit down in privacy, you don't want to be bothered. And they're staring you in your face is this anti-union poster. And again, as I explained in the book, you know, in the United States, far more than any other industrial nation, whether Japan, Australia, South Korea, Germany, Britain, France, Spain, Italy, you know, corporations in the United States are much, much more anti-union than in any other industrial nation. And in other industrial nations, generally, maybe companies don't love unions, but they see unions as legitimate institutions that companies are going to work with to try to achieve greater productivity and prosperity and profits. Whereas in the United States, companies like Amazon see the union as the enemy, as an illegitimate nuisance, and they will do, you know, anything to keep the union out. So, you know, I think a lot of workers in, you know, who work for Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama, really want a union, but Amazon is pressuring them so hard and propagandizing them so much that they might end up voting against a union, even though I think they're overwhelmingly inclined in the first instance to back a union. And I should also note, Ian, that, you know, union officials estimate that 85% of the workers in the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer are African American. And Bessemer itself is an old, you know, manufacturing steel town. It had steel mills, it had coal mines, it had a Pullman rail car plant, and it was heavily unionized. So it's a town that has a union tradition, even a radical socialist tradition. And some of the workers at the Amazon warehouse say, you know, their fathers, their aunts, their grandparents, you know, were union members at steel mills or coal mines or Pullman, and that, you know, their forebears, their, you know, grandparents are saying, you know, vote for the union, vote for the union. It will really help improve pay and treatment at Amazon.
So can you make the case that there's something about America and the American dream or whatever our vision of ourselves is that's against the idea that your fellow Americans should be able to have a living wage and have a decent life? I mean, I'm not sure how that gels with the pursuit of happiness.
Sure.
But what about the fact that we did have something of a social democracy in the post-war years, and we had powerful unions, or at least they're much more powerful than they are. They're down to 7% of the private workforce now. They were much higher then. And during the Eisenhower era, of course, the very rich in this country were paying 92% taxes, or at least they were required to pay 92% taxes. So, I mean, isn't there a correlation between social democracy and unions and minimum wages and all of what we're talking about?
Absolutely. And then, in my book, I explain in detail, you know, 1930s with the Great Depression here in the United States, workers are really taking it on the chin. Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to lift workers, wanted to lift the nation out of depression. So he and Congress enacted a law that made it far easier for people to unionize. And they saw that as a way for workers to increase their pay and increase their purchasing power. And that will help lift the whole economy. And in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, unions became much stronger, you know, led by social democratic union leaders like Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers. They, you know, they pressed General Motors and Ford and Chrysler to be paid much better, provide much better benefits. And this kind of created a much fairer economy where corporations are forced to share more of their profits and prosperity. And it was in the 1950s and 60s, thanks to this immense pressure and immense success of labor unions, that the world's largest, richest middle class was created in the United States. Fast forward to 1980, Ronald Reagan's elected president. The U.S. faces a recession. The U.S. is for the first time feeling great import pressure from, you know, Volkswagen and from Sony and from Toyota. And companies start getting much, much tougher towards their workers. They fight much harder to weaken unions. Wall Street becomes much more powerful. They pressure corporations and CEOs much harder to maximize profits. So that when in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, corporations were much more into sharing their profits fairly with their workers. And starting in the 1980s, there was much more focus on maximizing profits and maximizing share prices. And that meant workers increasingly got screwed. And you know, wages really haven't kept up. You know, companies used to, but, you know, when from the end of World War II through the 1970s, you know, as worker productivity increased, pay, worker compensation increased like one for one, hand in hand. But since around 1980, worker productivity has gone up about six or seven times as fast as worker compensation, as worker pay. So corporations are gaining much more of the increased productivity that workers are giving them, producing for them. And in, you know, as you said, in like 18 different ways, eight ways to Sunday, Ian. You know, American workers are really getting the short end of the stick. The minimum wage hasn't increased. Wages have stagnated for years and years. American workers don't, you know, many don't get paid sick days, paid vacation, paid parental leave. Don't, you know, we're the only industrial nation where all workers aren't guaranteed universal health coverage. So something is broken. You know, Americans overwhelmingly support giving, you know, guaranteeing paid sick days, paid vacation, universal health coverage for everyone. But, you know, corporate America and wealthy corporate donors have huge say in our politics. So even though on a certain level, there's a lot of social solidarity to make sure, in theory, that things are better for workers, just as we're seeing what's happening now with the minimum wage, even though the American electorate overwhelmingly supports it, it ain't happening because of wealthy donors, corporate power, and one political party that's totally beholden to corporate donors and the rich. And that's why, you know, far worse than in Europe, you know, workers in America are really held back in many, many unfortunate ways.
Well, this particular party that you're referring to is manifested down in at the CPAC conference in Florida as an anti-democratic party, where they're celebrating the insurrectionist behind the failed coup and wanting him to be their standard bearer in 2024. So one wonders whether corporate America will have some kind of wake up and recognize that they're supporting an anti-democratic party.
So to my mind, far too many corporations supported, you know, Trump's election, supported Trump when he was in power because he was reducing corporate taxes and getting rid of many regulations on corporations. To many corporations' credit, they were very upset when Trump tried to steal the election and say that his loss was all a fraud and a hoax. But, you know, it's still too many corporations are kind of immobilized. They still want to back the Republican Party and all its, you know, all its policies that are against what's best for workers, against what a majority of Americans overwhelmingly support. And as long as Trump maintains a large hold on, you know, Trump, as we all know, is a huge demagogue, and he pretends to be this great friend of workers. And if you look at what he achieved as president, he really did very little for workers. I mean, the minimum wage did not increase, you know, overall during his term. We ended up with fewer jobs than when he took office. He's the only president since Hoover who ended up with fewer jobs in office than when he took office. He handled the pandemic disastrously. He did far, 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 far too little to protect workers from, you know, workers' safety during the pandemic. And he, you know, his appointees did tons of things to weaken unions, to weaken worker protections. And many corporations were happy with all that. So on one hand, you know, I praise corporations for like being acutely uncomfortable with Trump's anti-democratic ways, but I don't think they've been nearly forthright enough in breaking off with a party that has become fundamentally anti-democratic. And I think our democracy really is going to be in big trouble if corporate America doesn't move more strongly, you know, against the Republican Party and their anti-democratic ways.
Well, just in the last minute, Stephen Greenhouse, do you think that the average American is going to be comfortable with a country in which you have a vast and growing underclass? Every day here in Los Angeles, as you drive under freeway overpasses, you see more and more homeless encampments like Hoovervilles from the Depression. There's a really interesting movie out now called Nomadland that follows a bunch of people on the road living as nomads out of RVs and vans, and actually film inside Amazon warehouse, as a matter of fact. So it just seems that it's inexorable what's happening. We really are having, in this divided country with growing income inequality, the underclass is growing visibly by the day, and so are the wounded and disposed of people forced to live in tents and scraps of cardboard under a freeway overpass.
Right. Yeah. What you talk about Ian, is a real tragedy, is really upsetting. If there is any silver lining to our horrible pandemic, maybe there are two silver linings. There's one, I think a lot of people realize that essential workers, you know, who have largely been invisible as fast food workers or janitors or cashiers at Walmart or Trader Joe's, people realize, hey, these people do super important work every day. You know, the FedEx delivery people, the UPS delivery people, and they're risking their lives every day doing their work. They're paid not very much at all. And that, you know, we, the American public, have come to appreciate their work, much more than we usually do. You know, all of us hear about all these heroes of Wall Street, all these heroes of Hollywood, they're great, they get all the attention. But I think, you know, one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that many Americans realize these essential workers are super important, they're super courageous, they're super dedicated, they risk their lives, and we, the American people, have to do more to support them, to have them earn more, to have them treated better. And the second silver lining, I think, Ian, is many people before the pandemic, you know, we're making a decent living, had secure economic lives, and whoops, the pandemic came. And it's not just, you know, the long-term homeless who are hurting. A lot of, you know, regular middle-class Americans suddenly find themselves, oh my gosh, I've been laid off from my hotel job. I've been laid off from my restaurant job. I've been laid off from my airline job. And I think people see that we as a nation need a better safe, better social safety net and a, you know, stronger and broader and larger social safety net, because anyone can be hurt in some economic downturn, economic disaster. And I think people are seeing far more than 2 and 3 years ago before the pandemic about the importance of social solidarity, of a strong safety net, of helping those who fall through the cracks. So you look at this $1.9 trillion emergency relief bill that Biden is pushing. You know, another silver lining is many Republicans, even many Trump supporters in the public, support that because they see, despite what Trump says, despite what many Republican lawmakers say, they see that social solidarity is important. They see that it's important to help those who are struggling, those who fell through the cracks, those who've been hurt very badly by the pandemic. So hopefully one of the good things that come out of this pandemic is more social solidarity and a greater social cohesion in trying to lift those at the bottom.
Well, Stephen Greenhouse, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be here, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Greenhouse, who was a reporter for the New York Times from 1983 to 2014, where he covered labor and the workplace for 19 years. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And his latest articles at The Guardian are We Deserve More, and Amazon Warehouses, High Stakes Union Drive, and A $15 Minimum Wage Isn't Just About Justice, It's Good Economics. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the claim by Mary Trump that her uncle will end up in jail as a result of the information handed over by the Supreme Court to the New York prosecutors.
I work for the union 'cause she's so good to me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, with the Trump's taxes now, with the Manhattan DA, there's a lot more going on than just looking into the payoff to Stormy Daniels and the former Playmate model Karen McDougal. And it looks as if the Manhattan investigators are focused on bank loans, insurance applications, and other kinds of financial transactions related to the Trump organization. But when you hear from Trump's niece, Mary, that she expects Trump to end up in jail. Is that wishful thinking? I mean, I certainly think he should be in jail. How else do you break the spell of those people down in Florida over this weekend celebrating Trump at CPAC? And they have become the Republican Party, and Trump is the Republican Party. And this, they're celebrating a man who conducted a failed coup against American democracy, and they're celebrating the idea that they can run with him in 2024 and take back the government. So it's just...
Yeah, it's really a remarkable rise of criminality to the very top. And, you know, if you include all the people that he pardoned, people like Steve Bannon, you know, Manafort, who's getting back $19 million of New York property to use that he didn't pass along to the prosecutors. You know, this is an incredible kind of coup already from the standpoint of impunity for, you know, high level crimes. Whether or not Trump is going to be able to be indicted on these charges, you know, the most interesting stuff, I think, has to do with possible discrepancies between his tax returns and the loan documents that he filed when he applied for financing from institutions like Ladder, which refinanced his some of his real estate holdings in New York in the late 2000, sort of around the 2009-2010 period, and Deutsche Bank, which financed a number of his investments at a time when other banks could not, you know, did not lend money to the Trump Organization because Trump had had sort of six bankruptcies in the 1990s. So these are two of the key institutions that I'm sure the prosecutors are looking at. Under U.S. law, there is a 10-year statute of limitations for bank fraud. On the federal statute, provides for up to $1 million in fines and up to 30 years of imprisonment if you're convicted. But whether or not the statute of limitations can be told in this situation is not clear. It depends upon to what extent there was concealment fraud, you know, during the period that might have extended the statute of limitations. So that's really a technical legal question. But there's no question. Yeah, there's no question that Cyrus Vance, you know, who's been mentioned as having gubernatorial ambitions in New York. Cuomo's up for re-election in 2022 and is kind of shaky at the moment. But, you know, it's no question that he has quite a bit of information to look at, not only with Trump, but also some of the associates of Trump.
Well, speaking of that, he's been meeting with Michael Cohen a number of times, at least four times, and as recently as Thursday.
Yeah. No, I think that Cohen is probably in a good position to testify. The other figure that's come to the surface here just the last month is our old friend Felix Sater, who was one of Trump's key financiers. And it turns out that as recent as 2017, Sater and a pack of folks from Kazakhstan were laundering money into not only the Trump Soho, but also into other New York properties to the tune of $36 million. So Trump, you know, and sort of Giuliani helped him set up the companies in the Netherlands that Sater was using to launder the Kazakh money. So that's another whole line of development that we have. There's no shortage of criminality, you know, financial criminality to look at here. The disappointment with Mueller was really that he kind of put this financial crimes business off limits and limited his inquiry to the, you know, kind of collaboration between Putin and the, you know, and, I mean, the Trump election team and some of the Russians. But, you know, now we may be able to finally get a look at that, at this stuff in more detail, not only through Vance, but also I'm hoping some U.S. federal prosecutors may want to look at some of the Sater stuff and specifically. David K. Johnson and I have an article that's coming out this week about these new revelations about Sater.
So prosecutors, of course, do have other sources, just as reporters do. So presumably Vance read the New York Times when they published Trump's tax records. Obviously, they've gotten a lot more because they've gotten the Mazars tranche of documents. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that those documents relating to Deutsche Bank loans could be where the real smoking gun is, because it's very likely that that private banking arm of Deutsche Bank wouldn't lend to Trump like nobody else would, but these loans were guaranteed by Russian oligarchs tied to Putin.
Well, that's a distinct possibility. You know, Deutsche Bank was convicted of money laundering a couple years ago, doing mirror trades from its Moscow office with its New York office. Its former chairman is now chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, which is a kind of notorious bank, has been quite a laundromat for Russian money. And he was in power during the period in which this a lot of this lending to Trump was done. So there's, you know, and two of the private bankers who are most involved, I mean, one of them committed suicide last year in a very untimely way that suggested some concerns about, you know, some of the Trump documents coming out. So I think there's a lot to look at with respect to Deutsche Bank. Were some of these loans that Deutsche Bank made to Trump, you know, at a time when no other banks would lend to him, underwritten or guaranteed by any Russian interests is a key question. So I'm hopeful that German authorities will collaborate closely with the U.S. prosecutors on this case.
So you are on the board of Amnesty International. You just brought up the Russians. What's going on there? Because I understand that a pro-Russian journalist with RT or one of the RT propagandists, and there are a lot of them, unfortunately, who do seem to transmit Russian propaganda. Well, anyway, tell us what's going on.
Well, there was kind of this unfortunate reversal by the international organization that's based in London. And, you know, it's, Amnesty is quite a complicated organization. I'm on the board of the U.S. section, and I'm not really authorized to speak for the organization. So this will be just my own personal reflection. Navalny, as you know, returned to Moscow from having been poisoned last year in Russia. He fled to Germany, got treatment, came back, thankfully survived. It looked a lot like the doing of Putin and his people, you know, this poisoning. And then Navalny kind of heroically said, no, I'm going back to Moscow. I'm going to stay in the fight. As soon as he gets back, he's arrested. He's charged with some, you know, rather dubious charges. But at the moment, he's off limits. He's been convicted and sentenced to 3.5 years in kind of record time.
In a labor camp, I might add. He's in the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere, totally inaccessible. So Amnesty, when he came back to Russia, designated him international, and I think correctly so, as a prisoner of conscience, in addition to being an ordinary political kind of activist and who's being persecuted. And that that kind of designation is reserved for people who are really distinctive internationally. But I think in this case, they suddenly got deluged with a lot of videos that, you know, it was kind of an organized campaign. It looks like Putin was behind it in terms of putting pressure on Amnesty to reverse its designation of Navalny as a prisoner of conscience. And it kind of succeeded because they took a look at some of these 14-year-old videos that he had made, which date from a period when, you know, there was a lot of Islamophobia. Russia was having this conflict with Chechens, and, you know, there were bombing incidents going on. So Navalny did make quite a few, according to these videos, quite a few, you know, sort of, you know, strong statements about Chechens. And, you know, 14 years later, Amnesty took a look at those and said, oh, my goodness, he, you know, so the purists in the organization said he was advocating violence or he was a racist. You know, I think the point is really that, first of all, Amnesty should not have made the designation in the first place if they, you know, a lot of these videos were available if they'd done due diligence. And secondly, they were, you know, really, I think, looking at his views 14 years ago, the guy has really matured and grown up since his 20s and has renounced those statements. So, you know, this was a really unfortunate reversal, and it handed Putin, you know, a propaganda victory at, you know, a time just when Navalny has put and his movement have assembled really kind of an impressive nationwide protest movement, also incredibly involved in exposing Putin's wealth and the wealth of his cronies, sort of unexplained wealth they've accumulated, including this monstrous residence that, you know, Putin denies owning it. It's all, you know, on some of the Black Sea. But it was a pretty interesting video about all that the Navalny's people put together. So Putin's are, you know, quite sensitive to Navalny. He refuses to mention him by name. But it's clear that this was a propaganda victory for Putin, courtesy of Amnesty International.
Well, I'm aware of a lot of journalists on the Russian, I don't know whether on the Russian payroll, but they're certainly useful idiots associated with RT. What was the role of one of these journalists?
There's a whole crowd of people that I would call, you know, friends of RT, and there's a well-known kind of almost a little clique of people who are, you know, without talking about them by name, they're associated with a group called the Gray Zone, one of the journalists involved there has been, you know, vehement about how the whole Trump-Putin relationship was a farce. And, you know, he'd been on that case for a long time. Many of the journalists in this crowd have been writing for RT or associated with it. They're often played up. And it just seemed odd that of all the people in the world who would receive the internal Amnesty memo, which, you know, Amnesty had been trying to keep quiet the fact they changed this designation, was this U.S.-based journalist, Aaron Mate, who, you know, was associated with a lot of these folks who've been, you know, supporting Maduro, supporting Assad, you know, writing for RT. I mean, they're a well-known kind of right-left crowd. Glenn Greenwald has occasionally associated himself with them and played. It's just a very peculiar kind of group that, you know, shows up on the on Tucker Carlson, criticized
right.
Left as much as anybody. So, you know, I think that they're rather minor influence on U.S.
Sure, but getting this document helped Putin, that's for sure.
By no question.
So I thank you for joining us, James Henry. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news site, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing